Well, welcome back to this next talk. And this one, of necessity, is coming closer to what's happening today, the United States. I want to begin by quoting to you from Liberty Magazine. I'm not embarrassed about quoting from my own magazine because I believe it's our magazine that's dealing with things that concern us. And on the back page of our November-December issue last year, we quoted Molly Ivins, a Texas journalist, and whether you like her or not, it's almost immaterial, because she made a very pertinent observation. She said, given the state of politics in this country, any reasonable person is entitled to conclude that politics could use an injection of the good book. But we are witnessing instead the very sort of divisive doctrinal disputation, the insistence that all citizens behave according to the beliefs of some, that led our founding fathers to the doctrine of separation of church and state at the beginning of this nation. The Establishment Clause of the First Amendment is what separates church and state. The founders were perfectly clear about what they were doing. It was put best by James Madison in that magnificent 18th century prose of which we are no longer capable. The purpose, he said, of the separation of church and state is to keep forever from these shores the ceaseless strife that has soaked the soil of Europe in blood for centuries. That's an interesting comment on where we now find ourselves in the United States. You know, the First Amendment is pretty much bread and butter for any of us working in religious liberty in this country, and it says in that amendment, Congress shall make no law establishing religion nor prevent the free exercise thereof. And we often talk about them as establishment or free exercise cases. An easier way to understand it is most times establishment concerns government support or separation of church and state issues regarding the state and church organizations. Free exercise is your practice of religion and most times relating to work and workplace issues. But the First Amendment seems plain. I can make it sound plain, but right now in this country there is a debate, but in some ways the argument has already been proven for most people that the separation of church and state is, as the Supreme Court Chief Justice Rehnquist said, an outmoded metaphor. Now that should cause Adventists to sit up and pay attention. Repeat it again. The Supreme Court Chief Justice Rehnquist has said that the separation of church and state is an outmoded metaphor. But many others go further than that. Dr. James Kennedy, who interestingly enough, you'll see when it comes out, the latest issue I've put together, we have an article from him. And that'll rattle a lot of people because he does not agree with most of our views. And I told him that we would publish it, but not to be surprised if we put a counter article next to it or an editorial footnote explaining where he's gone wrong. And he is wrong. He and many of his fellows, I'm not trying to pick on him, I hope not, but many good, moral, dedicated, sincere Christian leaders in this country, seeing the problem with immorality and the general decline of the moral tone of society, have determined that we need to somehow inject or impose even, they might not use the word impose, but it amounts to the same thing, legislatively create the environment where Christian values again become the norm for the United States. In 1906, when Liberty Magazine was established, Seventh-day Adventists were very affronted because the National Reform Movement, as it was called, which in some ways was an outgrowth of what had been part of the Temperance Movement, but they took it the next step further, as, by the way, very likely, in my view, the Constitutional Amendment on Marriage would be taken the next step to other parts of the Christian agenda. And the National Reform Movement had openly stated not only that they wanted Sunday legislation, but this was just a little part within an overall plan to redefine in some legislative, constitutional way the United States as a Christian nation. And that is what we have now. And it sounds wonderful to someone of superficial Christian concern. They would think, yeah, you know, let's make this a Christian notion. Let's say that it's Christian. Let's not let it go to you know, secularism, or let it become this or that or the other, or some other ism, or you know, to Islam. Or, I mean, there's many threats that can be perceived. But they're missing the whole point of the founders of this country. They're missing the whole point of the freedom of religion. But they are missing it. And currently, James Kennedy in particular, and some of his fellows in the Christian right, are literally salivating at the prospect of a law that they expect to be passed soon. They've popped it up several years running, and every time it gets more support, called the Religious Houses of Worship Act. And I don't imagine you've heard about it, but the Religious Houses of Worship Act is the most curious piece of legislation, coming as it does on the heels of campaign reform legislation, which was designed to limit politicians and political parties' ability to raise unlimited amounts of money from particular donors. Under the Religious Houses of Worship Act, churches, both an organization like the Seventh-day Adventist Church, well, I hope not like, because I hope we wouldn't participate, but say the Methodist Church, but a particular Methodist Church. So any religious organization whatsoever could raise unlimited monies purely for political purposes, use all of the facilities of the church to send out letters, to preach sermons, to bring politicians in, buy advertisements on the television promoting particular candidates as well as parties. In other words, just open go as political action groups. If that were to happen, clearly the separation of church and state would become null and void, would be in fact turned on its head, where the churches could easily, or at least a major church group, could probably exert more influence than a given political party. But this is their aim, and it's all under the rubric of what I'm sure you've heard, if you've read anything at all about the faith-based initiative of this present administration. They want a level playing field. And they've created a false construct where the churches don't have a chance to play fair for the public ear. It seems to me that churches have literally the bully pulpit, where people can spread views and so on through the church organization. And some churches have been too politically active. And you know, I'm embarrassed when I talk to you today and recording on this topic, not necessarily by what I say, but I'm embarrassed at the risk that it may sound political in the worst sense. We calculatedly, and as a matter of principle, dare not become involved in politics. But that hardly prevents us from speaking about and describing the political situation, and even explaining some of the dangers that are ahead in that regard. We have to be very, very plain. Ellen White is quite specific, though. She says, any minister or teacher who plays partisan party politics, she said, should immediately resign or be fired from their position. We are not to be involved in politics, but we hardly can be disinterested in what political developments bring that affect the church. And I think it would be irresponsible, it would be negligent from our doctrinal as well as the historical point of view, for us to enable this new trend toward political, direct political power by the churches. But it's a natural outgrowth of this new paradigm. And as I said last session, it derives very directly from the common fear of Catholicism removed. And now the Catholic Church, of course, has always had a certain comfort zone about working with the government. The Protestants now have their fear removed. They have a fear of secularism, so they'll unite with the Catholics and gain power to define this as a Christian nation. It sounds good on one level, it's prophetic on another, and it's clearly, arguably, a dangerous development. A year and a half, or maybe 2 years ago now, I remember attending a rally for the Choice Act, they were calling it then. It was the second half of the faith-based initiative that you may have read quite a bit about, a plan to use government funds through church entities to accomplish different welfare programs. There's been a lot of misinformation spread on this in the last 4 years. The faith-based initiative passed itself off as really a very benign way of, as I said, processing money through church agencies where we're doing a good work, but it wouldn't necessarily advance church ends. Part of the way to explain that this was a misinterpretation or a misrepresentation was that before this last administration, the Democrat president did have a similar thing called charitable choice. Charitable choice, which we also in the Religious Liberty Department felt was problematic, did just what they're saying this new one will do. It took government welfare money and processed it through church welfare programs, as long as they did not have overt spiritual programming in that environment, they could use the money. So clearly, if that was all it was, we didn't need faith-based initiative. The faith-based initiative goes the next step further. It is not a problem with this new program if the church mixes this government welfare expenditure with their evangelism or their faith projection. And, you know, we might think in this particular church that's fine to have the government fund us to go out and run medical clinics and so on where we hand out religious literature and try to convert them to our church. Do you want every other church to do the same? Probably not. Would you be comfortable with, say, radical, somewhat terroristically inclined Muslim organization to do that? Certainly not. And that was the first danger sign on this as the president pushed this program through. Several of the Christian right leaders, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, for example, came out publicly, suddenly, even though they were supporting it, condemning the faith-based initiative, because specifically they didn't want Farrakhan with the Nation of Islam to get the money. So that should be a danger sign. But I attended this this rally of the choice legislation. It was its second phase. It had passed through Congress as the House Resolution 7 very easily, since it was a Republican Congress. It was stalled for a while with the little shift that had taken place in the Senate, but then as the move became more favorable, it appeared inevitable that it would get through. And so I went to this rally, and it was like a camp meeting. All the religious groups were there, and they weren't making any bones. This was their coming into power. They were getting government money, and they were going to just run with it. This would be amazing. The government and the churches were co-partners now. And I sat next to a woman from Phoenix, and she was in charge of a religious charitable organization, and we got to talking, and I said, you know, I edit Liberty Magazine. Oh, that's interesting. I said, yes, we, you know, our principle is standing for the separation of church and state. I really shouldn't have told her that in that environment, but that's what we stand for. And I was shocked at how reflexly she shot back at me. She said, separation of church and state, we don't believe in such a thing. And in case I misunderstood her, a little bit later than that, I was watching on TV, and Bill Bright, founder of Campus Crusade, who's now dead, a man who did a wonderful ministry in his lifetime. I'm sure he was a committed Christian. But on this, he was horribly wrong, because he looked at the camera and he said the separation of church and state is a satanic concept. That will show you the degree of dislike for what once was the operative constitutional norm in this country. It came under the description of the famous commentator of American things. I'm trying to think the fellow who toured the U.S. in the mid-1800s. But anyhow, he interviewed people, and he said they all, from the politician to the minister, to the highest to the lowest, ascribe the dynamic strength of religion in America to was Alexis de Tocqueville was the commentator, and he says they all described the strength of religion in this country to the separation of church and state. But not today. Now it is seen as the problem. And you'll get it in many, many different ways. And I know Adventists are as confused as other people about this, because it might seem problematic to you that in a certain instance, school prayer is forbidden. And you think, oh, these these faithful teachers or students not allowed to pray in that public school. What a shame, you know, that we're going to the dogs. Or somewhere else, they'll tear down a Ten Commandment that is taken from public display. If you really think about it carefully, it's not an attack on religion. It's an inhibition applied to religious zealots of one type or another that want to put their version up and ram it down someone else's throat. And that clearly is the dynamic that's taking place now with Judge Moore, for example, who has flouted the law at every step. I mean, that should be very telling. His religion was not inhibited, but he was quite prepared, as someone sworn to uphold the law, to thumb his nose at the entire system. And you know, you need, part of the way to understand him, of course, is to know that he's also hung up on states' rights, you know, a pre-Civil War argument, and he does not accept that the federal government has the authority over him. But beyond that, it's the front line of a battle to formally designate this as a Christian nation along a form of definition that he has. And the Ten Commandments that you'll read, you might not recognize some of it. The Sabbath commandment does not specify the seventh day. Very abbreviated form that they're quite comfortable with. So we should be careful. Ellen White has instructions to our church that we shouldn't fight against, for example, the Bible being studied in public schools. She says it's not right, it's not legal, but it will happen, and when it happens, we should take some advantage of it, because people will certainly come to the truth by reading the Bible. There's no question about that. So we need to be careful in decrying this, as I'm clearly doing now, not to always put a moral construction on it. A wrong can come from it, but complete to itself, it's not harmful for people to see the Ten Commandments. It's not harmful for people to pray. It's not harmful for people to study the Bible. But it could be harmful if in a certain school your child was forced to read the Quran. It could be harmful if in a certain state your child was forced to read the Book of Mormon. It could be harmful if your child was forced to study a Dewey version of the Bible that has things quite a little different from yours. So it opens the door for an abuse of which the founders of this country were well aware. Remember, these were people that had escaped all sorts of religious and political tyranny in Europe. They were determined not to establish it here. Something that I want to introduce, and I usually do, but I know I have a little advantage that I studied history and at least started studying history outside this country. But I have a burden that part of the way to understand the nature and the makeup and the intentions of this country is to look a little further back than the War of Independence and the context that the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence came from. You know, there's a lot of glib talk, especially at Thanksgiving, about the Pilgrim Fathers. But other than a recognition that they came originally from England by way of Holland, it's like, you know, they might as well have burst full-blown out of the earth. Very few people seem to realize that just barely one century before the American War of Independence, England had a civil war. And the civil war was of a very particularly religious nature. England, of course, was a Protestant country. And under the guise of, well, not under the guise, but under the model of Protestantism, it brought freedoms that had been denied it under a worldwide Catholic control, but it was still hardly tolerant of every version of Christian faith. So there was some persecution. John Bunyan is one example in that time frame where he was quite persecuted for being an independent preacher. But there was a period, as I say, just barely 100 years before the Declaration of Independence here in England, when Protestant people in America of all factions were studying their Bibles, there was a religious stirring. It was the context of John Bunyan. It followed shortly after, although it was maybe about 50 years or so earlier that the King James Bible was brought out, but the Bible was freely available, and Protestantism flourished. There were all sorts of different groups. The Puritans were just one of them. And it became offensive to them that their king, who was married to a Catholic woman, was seemingly to trying to reintroduce Catholicism into England. The Archbishop, of Canterbury. Tried to change the prayer book, which was analogous to changing the church manual for Seventh-day Adventists, I guess. And they projected on him an intention of bringing back the modes of worship of the Catholic Church. And he definitely was a very formal, high church, old-style religious fellow. And all of these different independent thinkers and studiers in the country just rose up and challenged the king. And of course, one of the avenues they did it through was Parliament. But beyond that, there was agitation out and around. And Charles did not like, King Charles, the king at the time, did not like this. So he tried to shut down Parliament, which is probably not a good thing for any ruler to do. And Parliament soon took after the king. And in very quick order, the supporters of the king found themselves on open warfare in the field against the supporters of Parliament, who very quickly became Protestant factions with a religious agenda. Well before the Civil War ended, it was a religious war to overthrow a Catholic king and install religious prerogatives of these dissenters. And there were several main factions. There were the Puritans, of course. There were the Levellers. And these men had been studying Daniel and Revelation. We think that it just sort of suddenly popped up with Adventists and the Enlightenment or the awakening that happened in the mid-1800s here. But England experienced the same interest in Daniel and Revelation. And they believed that God was about to come and the judgment was to be set. It was imminent and they were going to bring this about. And since it was imminent and we were all to stand at the judgment bar of God, they were going to level society in anticipation of it, since we're all equal. Another group, even more interesting to Seventh-day Adventists, were called the Fifth Monarchy Men. They were named that because their particular burden was the image of Daniel 2, and they believed in the fifth and final kingdom of God that would replace. And they wanted to bring in that fifth kingdom. And they believed that by overthrowing the king, in essence, they could establish a religious order in anticipation of Christ's return. And Oliver Cromwell, who emerged as the leader of this faction and then eventually was formally instated as the Lord High Protector, he didn't want to be king, he was basically a religious dictator, established and ruled this religious republic. It's where the American pioneers or the founders, in my view, got their general idea. But I believe they had looked at this rebellion of a religious nature that broke out. They saw how intolerant it became. They saw how Oliver Cromwell, for example, talk about anti-Catholicism, he took that to a fine art. Once Oliver Cromwell and his Roundheads, which was a modern army, in some ways it was a historical shift from the cavaliers and the court retainers, with the finery and all the fancy uniforms. Here, these Protestant farmers, most of them, not very well off, gentlemen, yeomen, and county landed gentry, but certainly no aristocracy. They just made uniforms that were utilitarian. They organized themselves as a crack military force, and they were unstoppable. And as soon as the war was over, Oliver Cromwell took his army over to Ireland and just put the Irish Catholics to the sword, wiped out whole towns. And to this day, they remember Drogheda, for instance. It was 50,000 people were killed in one town. And then he settled the English Protestants in Ireland. That's the legacy that I believe this country had inherited. Oliver Cromwell ruled unopposed for only about 5 or 6 years till he died. And his son took over from him, but within months, everything evaporated. And believe it or not, they invited the king's son back and reinstituted the monarchy. I find it unbelievable that barely a lifetime later in this country, as these founding fathers of this country formulated the republic that they would want, that they wouldn't be well aware of a religious dictatorship that had existed in England. They might have even been inclined to do something like that, except it was so patently obvious that it collapsed once the dictator died, that you could not impose religion upon a country. And I believe that that obviously combined with the Enlightenment thinking that they were influenced by, that combined with their undoubted deistic tendencies, you know, maybe nowadays we're not as confident on explaining deism, but deism as it existed in the 1700s was basically just a view that, yes, there was a creator God, he made everything, and then he went on vacation. So we're under the natural order now. Things just follow from cause to effect, but nothing more. No miracles. And there's no question that Benjamin Franklin, for example, as one of his best friends said when he was asked later, oh, yes, he says, Benjamin Franklin, sir, was a deist. And Thomas Jefferson, probably the best you could say of him as far as religion, he was a deist. He spent a lot of time at one stage going through the Gospels and striking out everything that he felt was a later addition or was, you know, not to be relied on, like he didn't believe in miracles or anything. So he sort of ended up with a little short version that he actually had printed, that it was the wise sayings of Jesus. That was sort of the long and the short of it with Jefferson. It shouldn't be necessary to prove that these men were anything less than high priests of Christianity to put the lie to this new paradigm that they were men who had an overt religious agenda to the country. But I think it's a matter of historical record that they themselves had a respect for religion. They were in a Christian context, but they had very clear cautionary tales in their own homeland. You know, after all these years, when the chips are down, we still close ranks with the British because there's a cultural affinity. That's hundreds of years. That's with all the communications that are going on, all of the other cultural inroads. But think of it in the world of their day. Little communication. You know, the telegraphs really didn't exist, obviously. They would wait for news on a boat that would take many, many weeks. Even when I came from Australia on a modern boat, it took 3 weeks to come from Australia. It would take every bit as long and not reliably to get news from England. But that's where they looked for their news. It was big news, even a lifetime later, that a religious dictatorship had failed in England. Not to mention that they still had this fear of Catholicism. Not to mention that they were fighting among themselves, in New England, they'd hung Quakers, and other places they'd chased this group or that group. It wasn't all sweetness and light, much as we like to think so. But there were many very religious, sincere people in various states, and when they compacted together, they set on a formula that would keep religion out of public life. They specifically, in the Constitution itself, said that there shall be no religious test for public office. You can't be plainer than that. And that's why Senator Leahy, recently, as I alluded to in the last session, was quite upset during the nomination process when some people were trying to dismiss some people because of their religious affiliation. We don't believe in such a thing, and it's easy to describe when we're talking about a certain point of Catholicism, say, how many, the increased influence of the Catholic power in the country. You know, that's descriptively valid, but we dare not object to someone holding a position just because they are Catholic, or just because they're Protestant, or just because they're whatever. And these guys were very, very confident with that. I tried to make a deduction that probably some lawyers would challenge, but I think logically it's there. You know, in the current debate over the Pledge of Allegiance, we're waiting for the Supreme Court to make a judgment on that. And I think it's very likely that they will uphold the language of the present Pledge of Allegiance, but in a narrow way that sort of says that it's, you know, they have a term they call ceremonial deism, or just a cultural statement that doesn't really reflect on an endorsement of religion per se. I have a feeling they'll do something like that. But it's quite problematic to have a pledge to a country that affirms a particular, or a faith in a particular God even, much as we might be dedicated and committed to upholding worship of the one God. But the connection that I tried to draw is, it's interesting, would seem against the intention of the founders, who specifically said in the Constitution that there shall be no religious test for public office. that yet we're requiring everybody, every student, by definition then everybody who grows up in this country, to affirm and to swear that they are supporting a country that is advancing God. It's sort of a double-edged sword, and it's the type of thing that makes people think very long and hard about what is religion, what is its role in the state. And it has to be, as I've tried to say earlier, a personal thing. And once it's your personal thing, nothing should stop you from expressing it to the limit. The gospel commission is without limit. It's to go to every nation, tongue and people. But it doesn't say, go and get this ruler and have him coerce all of his followers. In fact, the history of the advancement of Christianity is corrupted precisely because that happened. Remember, Clovis was baptized for the French, and the whole nation became French, became a Christian. You know, and they baptized this leader of that tribe, the Germanic tribes, everyone followed. That's not the way it works. It didn't work then. It brought in great apostasy, and now to just, you know, to wave a magic governmental wand over everyone and suddenly you are now a Christian will not be very good. Not be very good. The United States has definitely changed. And I'd like to tell you a story. I don't know where I am on the hour, but I want to tell you a story that seems to jump off from this, but it comes back to where we are in the United States. The first flight that I took after September 11, actually it was a two-parter flight, and the first one to Chicago was uneventful. But the second flight was from Chicago to Seattle, and it was in October, less than a month after September 11. And I was not keen on flying, and there was one of these big warnings out. And I remember too many things, and I remembered that coming up to the year, the 2000 millennium, you know, the millennium year, they caught an Al-Qaeda operative coming down from Canada intent on bringing down the Seattle Needle. So I thought, that's not a good place to fly as we're heading off to deal with Afghanistan. So I got on the plane in Chicago. It was a wide-body plane and full, as they always are anymore, it seems to me. And we were about 10 minutes out of Chicago, still climbing with the lights on, the seat lights on, and I heard a fuss behind me. And turned around and I looked, I was sitting in a window seat, and I looked back to the exit row, and sitting in the middle of the exit row, I looked straight into the eyes of my worst nightmare, a middle 20s perhaps, Middle Eastern fellow with a staring fanatical expression, looked scared out of his mind, and he leapt to his feet and ran for the restroom, and the stewardesses behind him, sit down, and he didn't, and he vanished into the restroom. So I kept looking back to see when he'd appear. And after quite a while, when they were agitated, they were very worried, he finally appeared and I saw him come back, and then I turned around again. And a moment later there was a whoomph, like a bomb going off. And that the plane was chaos, believe me, screaming and yelling, everyone up in their seats and just out of control situation. And it turned out this fellow had dropped. He hadn't just fainted, it was just like a dead weight, boom, on the floor. Stewardesses were screaming out for medical help, and then when people came, they were yelling them to get back and IDs, and they dragged the guy up to the pilot's cabin at one point, and people really screamed at that. Back! No! No! And in the middle of all of this, as I was standing up, I called across to the guy on the aisle across from me. I said, you know, I think this is a diversion. And he says, we must be vigilant. We must be vigilant. Right at that point, I noticed the guy sitting next to me that I'd said hello to was slouched down in his seat, hiding his face and acting very strange. And I looked at him, I suddenly realized he meets the profile too. Middle 20s, Middle Easterner, acting very suspicious. And I don't have the time to tell you the whole story, but very strange things happened, let me tell you. The only one I'll tell you that he did was one point when the other fellow went to the restroom, this fellow closed his eyes, leant against the seat, counted out with his fingers, 1, 2, 3, and on 3, just threw himself on the seat. So I complained a few times, and the stewardesses just didn't seem to know what to deal with the whole situation. They were out of their depth. So I thought, I've got to deal with this guy. So I opened one of my magazines at random almost, to a story of the Twin Towers, and it had a long quote from the Quran next to it. And immediately he was in on it. And I said, you know, I often read the Quran, I've read the Quran, but I don't know what the references mean. And he says, oh, it means the bull. So right away I knew I wasn't just typecasting him. So I began a conversation that obviously, this is not much suspense in this, you know we made the flight. But a conversation that at every point put the wind up me, scared me quite considerably. Because the first comment I made to him after that, I said, well, you know, why would anyone fly a plane into the Twin Towers? And he says, why not? It's the only way we can get America. Then I said that, you know, you mess with America. I said, there'll be world war on this. Fine, he says, we want world war. Then I went through a lot of the history, and I love history. I went through the history of England's dealings with the Middle East. And I said, why would you trouble America? I said, England done far more to frustrate the Arab cause. We don't care about England. England's finished, he said. It's America we want. Well, this was all very interesting. Found out this fellow had been out of the U.S. September 11. Because I'd been to different places, I was able to sort of draw out of him where he was. He'd come from Pakistan. He'd been in Afghanistan. Born in Qatar on the Persian Gulf. Radical Muslim that works in Chicago. So we got onto a lot of particular things about what this means. And so I referred him to Revelation 13. I said, you know, it says in the Bible that the United States is to play a role at the end of time. And I read him, remember in Revelation 13 verse 11, it says, then I saw another beast coming out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast. What's that first beast? That's the papacy. In his presence, and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire to come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. The only time I got this guy's undivided attention was when I said, you know, it says here, fire from heaven. It was early days then. We were just going to Afghanistan. I said, what if that means that there'll be some atomic bomb dropped on Kabul or Baghdad? And that threw him. And I'm not necessarily saying I believe it had to be, or certainly wasn't. But we don't know. But something will be done by this nation as a signal sign that it is the power. And what's the image that it's picking on? That's from what we spoke of earlier. There, Elijah on Mount Carmel, in front of the heathen priests there, and the people who were doubtful about who was really in charge. Elijah, as God's prophet, called down the very fire of God, and there are in front of them. We've got to be careful we don't mix figures. You know, you could say the fire is spiritual power. There's a fire engine. You could say the fire is spiritual power, but the figure in the Old Testament is a quite literal, visible bolt of lightning, if you like, from God. Something of that nature is to be done by this power in the sight of men. Something dramatic. I still don't know that it has to be nuclear, although you must be aware that as part of this shift that is clearly taken, we are living through Revelation 13. How much farther we go, who knows? We know where it ends, but we don't know the little steps along the way. But I think it's such a truism that it's not worth debating if it has actually happened. That since September 11, this nation that has stood for republicanism, has stood for freedom, has stood for Christian slash civil rights or human values, and indeed during the Cold War projected those against the Soviet Union in spite of their lack of a granting of those rights, and we demanded that they give those rights. Now we're saying, in spite of what was said in the last few days, it's been said, I've heard it over and over again, that we will not abide by the Geneva Convention. We will not give such rights to other people. That is an unprecedented shift. It has to be prophetic. And together with this, something analogous to that fire from heaven has to come. It affronted this fellow, and maybe that's what will put an end to this war without end, as Rumsfeld, I think, quite accurately predicts. That there's no way out of the spiral toward nihilism that we're entering into with a worldwide terrorist organization. And you know, I've traveled enough, I've talked to enough people to know it's not just two or three crazies. They are the crazy tip of a great assumption that billions of people share in this world. And Seventh-day Adventists should revisit, I believe, things that were written to us back in the time of Ellen White in Uriah Smith's Daniel and Revelation. There is an entire chapter there about the role that Islam played in enabling the Reformation. Europe nearly fell to Islam. A violent military attack that came up to the gates of Vienna. And it took hundreds of years to drive them back. And Uriah Smith says, and Ellen White endorses this interpretation, that this fulfilled, not present tense, it was in that era, it fulfilled the fifth trumpet of Revelation 9, where it says that these beings come out of the bottomless pit and their leader is Apollyon. So while that was the fulfillment, it's not likely that an erroneous system and a mortal threat to Christianity described that way now, under its present manifestation, is benign. It's just a few radical offshoots. We're in a mortal battle. And I'll tell you in the next session about Ambon, for instance, where tens of thousands of people are being killed in face-to-face, up-close and nasty machete and submachine gun fighting between Christians and Muslims, Adventists and Muslims. It's happening, and we were there last November, and it's happened again the last few days. Another 40 people killed. Fighting has broken out again there. We've moved through a prophetic and a historic shift in this country. When I first started this job, and I think I'm running out of time, aren't I? When I first started in this job, I always had thoughts about how the Constitution could be put away. Seventh-day Adventists, I know, have always had a fear of a constitutional amendment or a constitutional Congress being called where we would revisit the whole Constitution. But that's not the only way to take away freedoms. And certainly in the British system, which we are heirs to here, there's always been the understanding of the War Powers Act where everything's put away. And I made that comment to some of our religious liberty leaders a few years ago, and one of them said, you should read this book. And he gave me a book review, and I've since read the book, of a very interesting book that came out only about six years ago from William Rehnquist, Chief Justice. And it's called All the Laws But One, Civil Liberties in Wartime. That was before 9/11. And very interesting to see. It's not a long book. You can buy it. It's easily available, and you probably should read it. And he gives some interesting historical analyses. One that we all know, the imprisonment and internment of the Japanese in World War II. But he goes further back to the Civil War. And, you know, not my namesake. I wasn't named after Abraham Lincoln, but Abraham Lincoln, while he was a great president in most regards, was a little bit troublesome as the way he treated civil liberties. For example, when he tried to get troops down to the south at a moment of crisis, Washington, D.C. is basically a southern city, and he couldn't get troops through Baltimore. The troop trains were stopped, and crowds roughed up the soldiers and sent them back. So he was just fit to be tired. He said, there's traitors in the midst and everything. So he suspended the writ of habeas corpus. And we should know what that is, because it's going to be a major issue, if not already. Where under the Constitution you have a guarantee of your person against arbitrary arrest and indefinite imprisonment without trial. He suspended that and just sent the soldiers out to round up people he thought were enemies and rounded them up, locked them up, and that's it. The Supreme Court Chief Justice at that time was quite affronted by this and took to the streets railing against an incipient dictatorship. And so President Lincoln put out a warrant for his arrest, and at the last minute was dissuaded from executing it. That's the sort of stuff that has happened. And Rehnquist goes through this, and amazingly, when he comes to the conclusion, he says the executive powers of the president, executive orders, which we're well familiar with now, he says that these have been abused in the past, used and abused in the past. He says, and they will be used, but hopefully not abused in the future. Amazingly, even though his predecessor was under an arrest warrant for objecting to such a thing, he gives the green light to this thing. And it's quite possible, maybe not the only way it's going to go, but it's possible, even in a democracy such as ours, that the privileges that we have under the Constitution, religious liberty just being one of them, but a preeminent liberty, they could be put away like that. Probably by the nature of the society we live in and of the scenario that Ellen White paints and the Bible predicts, I think it would probably be with the popular encouragement of most people in an emergency clamoring for a certain response. But we don't need a law. We don't need laws for it. We just need a dictate. And remember what it says in Revelation 13. He deceived those who dwell on the earth by these signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast. He was granted power to give breath to the image. And it says, he causes all, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. I don't know. You don't want to lose your credit rating now. You pretty much can't buy or sell. We're well along into a morph from one system of benign, lamb-like beast to the other phase. When the penny will really drop, we don't know, but I can tell you the penny's in the slot. Last session we spoke about the revitalization of the Roman power and all that it represents from the compulsions of the Middle Ages. Connected that to the predictions that Ellen White made for this country aligning with that power. Now with Revelation 13, we see in present events a very clear shifting to the second phase. What is the next thing? There's nothing that I read in my Bible of a particular nature to come yet except the Sunday law. Well, I take that back because there's one very other important other thing. It's sort of one and the same. There must be a revival and a loud cry given before that Sunday law. And I wish that I could find that quote that I lost two sessions ago. But Ellen White talks about the wheel of providence coming around. And as I read it, it sounds vaguely Buddhist, and you know, there's the wheel of life and so on. We don't believe in that circularism in that sense. But I believe that the dynamic that we're in again has been in the past. I've seen other signs of it, but now there's just so many fingers of causality coming together. But I believe that we've had chances and it's coming around again, and if God's people speak out and say what this means and call people out of Babylon, call people for a preparation to Christ's return, that with that revival will come the wrap-up and the wheel will cease and we will go straight through to the second coming of Christ. Thank you for your attention, and as has often been said, may God bless America as it certainly as it follows His will, and may God help it not to betray what it has so historically stood for and that has really done so much to protect religious liberty over the years.
You've been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2004, American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. For additional cassettes or CDs by this speaker, or for a free catalog of other American Cassette Ministries resources, please contact us as follows. Visit our secure website at www.americancassette.org. Our entire catalog is online, plus thousands of other selections to choose from. We accept Visa, MasterCard, and Discover credit cards. Our email address is info@americancassette.org. To order toll-free in the United States and Canada, dial 800-233-4450. For international orders, dial 717-652-7000. For fax orders, dial 717-652-9050. Or you may simply write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 17108 in the United States of America. Maintaining the integrity of the Three Angels' messages for 29 years, American Cassette Ministries requests your continued prayers and financial support as we strive to provide you with the finest, most powerful spiritual messages available. Our one purpose in ministry? To prepare you and your loved ones to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.